It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You're listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Boom. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned into 2A Radio, the Second Amendment radio show. Of course, you can always find us at 2aradio.com. Of course, all the archives are there as well. And today, for this weekend's episode of 2A, we're going to talk about several things. First of all, we're going to end up getting into a recap of last weekend's three-day precision rifle course and really how it went and some of the really neat things that went on there, some of the great experiences that some of the folks had. And, of course, the results that went on. We also have a guy by the name of DJ Pesciotta in the office. DJ Pesciotta was working as a Las Vegas Metro cop, my old alma mater, and got embattled into some BS that he was cleared of, but at this point in time has lost his job. So DJ's going to be in here talking about that to get his side out there. As it turns out, without having known much of anything, the sheriff of Las Vegas Metro got on the air and started piping off about several things, from what I heard, and without knowing the facts, which is actually par for the course for this particular sheriff. As well, we're also going to have Eric Severson of the Appleseed Project. He's going to be dropping in later in the show. He's going to talk a little bit about Appleseed, and then we're just going to kind of shoot the breeze a little bit about rifles and even some reloading and things like that in general. So, without further ado, I would like to welcome DJ Pesciotta into the studio. DJ, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You're going to have to be a little bit closer to that microphone,
okay.
My man.
Good, good.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Good so, you are, what, about 22, 23 years
24
old?
24 years old, yeah.
24 and a year. Yeah, you look like a kid, man.
You
look
well,
like
thank
a kid.
You.
Now, I was on Las Vegas Metro back in the mid-90s. Okay. You got hired not quite 18 months ago.
May of 09.
May of 09.
Yeah,
okay,
was
so
my start month.
That was your start. Now, from what I understand, at least when I was on, after 18 months, you were off of probation. Has that changed?
No, it's about the same.
It's about the same.
Yeah, you will go through six what they call FTOs, field training officers, and then each of them you'll be with them for about 3 weeks each.
Yeah, same deal I was on.
And then you're done.
So, what was your hire date?
5/14 of 09 was my start date.
So you passed your 18 months.
Yep,
you have civil service protection.
Yep.
So
well,
are you going to...
I'm still considered what's called on probation because it's 1 year after you graduate field training that you're on probation with Metro. I don't know if that changed with... You know,
yeah, with me, when I was on back in the day, it was 18 months from your date of hire.
Yeah, okay.
18 months from your date of hire. Now what you're saying is once you've completed field training... It's a year after that.
Yep, yeah.
When did you complete field training?
Actually, I would be done with supposed to be done with field training on April 9th or 29th of this month. So it was supposed to be my last day of probation. So I'd been considered a PO2 after the 29th of April.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start off. This segment, we've only got about 4 minutes left or so. But let's start off with what happened. You were working... As a Las Vegas Metro officer out there, you're on probation, you're working, what, south, central, down, south of the Strip?
I was actually working Convention Center, so which
convention
is the Strip.
Center.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically kind of center
yep.
Strip area.
Yep.
Same old stopping grounds I used to patrol, kind of the Mary Nora areas
oh, yeah,
for the
yep.
sector beats. And so you're working, everything's fine, you have a girlfriend, right?
Yeah.
And tell us, what happens?
Give
us dates and stuff as
okay.
well so we can kind of follow this timeline.
About January of this year, she started going a little crazy. And I kind of broke it off going back and forth with each other. So we had our good days and bad days.
Now, were you living together or just seeing each other?
Yeah, we were living together.
Okay.
We were living together. Early March, kind of got real bad to the point where both of us were like, we're done. I was actually helping her out because she has no place to go at all. She's broke and has nothing.
Okay, no, so you guys were living together, and she really had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you didn't want to be in this.
Right. So at the beginning,
you don't cohabitate.
Yeah. At the beginning of March, I actually had her sleeping on my couch just because I was, you know, felt sorry for her. So that's where all that started from.
Gotcha. Okay.
I was at the point of booting her out completely, telling her to go get her own place and do her own thing because I was just done with it. And she knew that I was doing that, so she called the cops on March 18th.
March 18th. She called Las Vegas Metro on you.
Yes.
Okay.
What happened was early that morning on the 18th, I was passed out because I just got done with what's called EVOC training, which is driver's training on the 17th. So I actually went home, went to bed, and I was done. Woke up to her coming home real late, smelled of alcohol a little bit. She had some alcohol, an odor of alcohol on her, and had a small argument. I told her pretty much to leave because I ain't arguing. I'm going to bed. We had a little argument. She left. Came back in the, or she called.
How many times did you hit her that night?
Oh, I've never hit a girl.
But as I understand, she made other claims.
Yeah, what she's claiming was that night, that morning, the argument turned into me trying to rip her keys out of her hands and shoving her out my door and pushing her downstairs. So
how did that go for you?
Oh, well, it's BS.
Okay.
But that never happened.
Okay.
So what happened was she left, came back later that night and was like, hey, can I sleep here? And I let her sleep on the couch. She wakes up real late that morning of the 18th to go to work. And
curiously, what kind of work does she do?
She is a shift supervisor at the CVS pharmacy.
Okay.
So she's just a manager kind of figure.
Gotcha, yeah.
So she goes to she leaves my house real late that morning because she had to be to work at 8 and she left at 10. So she woke up and was like, oh, crap, I got to go to work. Bolts out the house, is gone. So I'm like, okay, later. I go about my business, realize her purse is on the couch at my apartment. And I'm like, hey, I text her. You want me to bring you your purse or you want me to what do you want me to do? You left it here. So I go, you know, decide I'm just going to bring it to her at her work. At the same note, we were, both of us were broken up. She still had property of mine in her vehicle. So I went to her work. I had a spare
key. So in your private car, you had some of her stuff in it?
In her car, I had some of my stuff.
Oh, some of your stuff was in her car.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
And she knew that. And also, us being cohabited, I actually have a spare key to her car. She had a spare key to my truck also. So I just showed up to try to work and was like, hey, I'm not leaving your purse in your car because I know the neighborhood and it has a lot of auto burglars in this neighborhood. She refused to come outside. I just grabbed what was mine and left. I get a phone call from her.
And what did you do with the purse?
I just left it in my truck because I was going to bring it back home and drop it off at the house and say,
okay,
you know, when you're done with work, come get it because I'm not leaving it in your car.
Right.
So she calls me and was like, hey, that's messed up. You stole my purse and whatever. And I'm like, no. I even have text messages proving it that, you know, she knew I was coming down there to drop her stuff off and she knew that I was picking my stuff off and I had the key and everything.
That music is letting you know we're leaving this segment. He's looking around the studio. What is that noise,
music,
man?
Going on.
That's all right, DJ. Hold on just
okay,
a second because
no
we'll get back to you. Guys, stay tuned. We're going to get to a little bit more involved in this story and see what it is that happened with young Officer Pashota and how hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Coming up next on 2A Radio.
Irresponsible people have no business owning a gun or listening to this show. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
And welcome back from the break, everyone. Again, we're sitting down here with DJ Pashota, who is working for Las Vegas Metro as a police officer. We're in the middle of the story, kind of setting the groundwork to what happened here. Now, where we left off, you and your girlfriend, somewhat a strange girlfriend, you weren't really seeing each other, but you
right
were still letting her stay at your place because she had no place better to go.
Right.
As it sounds, that's kind of stand up, but at the same time, you kind of wanted her out. She leaves her purse at your place. You send her a text message, look, I'm bringing your purse. She wanted you to leave it in her car. You said, no, there's a lot of auto burglaries. I don't want that to happen. But you got into her car with the key that you had, and
yep,
you had keys to each other's vehicles.
Yes.
And she had a key to your place, too?
Oh,
is
yeah
that okay?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So everybody had keys to everything. You were still cohabitating, and that was her legal residence.
Right.
So you went and got your stuff out of her car, and then since she wouldn't accept her purse, you took it back to the house where it'd be safe.
Right.
That's where we left off.
Right.
She's saying that she didn't like that you wouldn't just leave her purse in the car.
Correct.
Okay. Now, so, curiously, do you know, when she was at work, did she normally leave her purse in the car? Normally take it in?
She's a typical female. She takes her purse everywhere she goes.
So why didn't she take it inside?
I wouldn't go into her store. She actually originally wanted me to go into her store. I told her, no, I ain't going in her store, because there's a few people that she works with that mean we just don't get along.
Okay.
So I just told her to come out and grab it. And all you got to do is walk out the door, and I'll hand it to you, and you know, we'll put
right.
it in
the and that was a no-go for her?
That was a no-go for her. Okay. So I told her I wasn't leaving in her car.
It sounds to me like a bit of a competition in urination is what it sounds
yeah.
like. A bit of a pissing contest.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which, you know, happens in most relationships at one time or another. Look, here's your purse. Just come outside here and get it. Trying to meet you halfway. No, it's not halfway in. Blah, da, 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 so it, back and forth. And how old is she?
She's 25.
25, you're 24. So, you know, younger folks.
Right.
All right, so I can definitely see this going on. And again, I'm pontificating. I don't really know. We have met one time before, you and I, just so everybody in the audience knows. Your father and I have become buddies of sorts. I met your dad. He was a student of mine for years ago. And you and your dad came out, what was it, about 6 or 7 months ago, we did a one-day rifle class. I owed your dad something. He had done me some favor. I don't even remember what it was. I remember. He came out to my house. Your dad's a plumber, and he did a whole bunch of plumbing around my house on the cuff. And then I, in turn, said, okay, you can get a day of handgun or of
rifle precision rifle.
Firearms training. And you and your dad came out and did rifle training. Yep. We shot out to 500 yards.
That was fun.
Yeah, I remember you had a first-round dead center hit at 500 yards your first time with that gun.
<Beat him. laughs>
So anyhow, there's the groundwork there. So carry on. We had this this little bit of a pistol contest. You ended up going home with her purse. That's where we left off.
Yeah, I ended up leaving because I was just going to drop it off back at the house. She calls me yelling, ranting, and raving that I, you know, stole her purse. She said time and time before that she knows I'm a cop, and she knows that she can get me in trouble for just stupid crap if I ever left her. She's actually said those words to my sister, because her and my sister are really good friends for a while.
I heard similar things from people that I knew when I was a cop.
Right.
Yeah, you know, if you don't da-da-da-da-da, I'll file a false report on you.
Complaints and stuff, yeah. So she's made comments like that in the past, and knowing that our relationship is pretty much done, she saw her opportunity, I guess. So what she did was she called the cops, knowing that that's my area command that I work, because that's where she works as well. Calls, everybody and their mother shows up. So she's like,
and what was her claim when she called?
She called and said that I stole her purse out of her car. That's what she's claiming. When she supposedly she had a friend that works there that ran into the store and was like, "Hey, your boyfriend just stole something out of your car."
Okay, so she actually had some sort of collaboration,
right,
on her
friend,
story.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that friend filled out one of those voluntary statements. Not one. He mentioned that I was at her car and that he saw me with the door open. There's nothing saying that he saw me in her car, taking anything.
Okay.
So nobody even saw me take anything out of her car.
Okay.
I mean, and the only thing I ever said was, I took my stuff that was mine.
Was there any surveillance video in
the
parking lot?
No, okay. No surveillance, no nothing.
Curiously, for the people who know Las Vegas, where is this?
Harmon and Paradise.
Okay, so not the best area.
Right
town.
Across from the Hard Rock Hotel, which is really not that good of an area.
No, it's not.
So,
however, across the street on the other side is the Hofbrau House, which has some great beer
that
and bratwurst.
True. That is true.
Yeah, my birthday's actually, just to digress, during Oktoberfest, and I usually head over there.
Well, there you go. Yeah, well, there's a lot of auto burglaries over there. Real, real bad. So, so she calls me back and was like, "Hey, bring my purse back." And I'm like, "Just come out to get it. I'll bring it back." So I come back to her work. So I'm just like, "Here, take it. You know, I don't care." I pull in the parking lot, and Metro is everywhere. So I get out of the car and walk up to the cops, and I'm like, "Hey, guys, I know why you're here." "Well, why is that?" "Well, because I know she called." So, because she did. She told me she was calling the cops, and I was like, "Whatever." I went to jail that night for battery domestic violence because they're claiming that because of her claims of me ripping the keys out of her hands and throwing her to the ground.
And she said this happened the night before?
She said this happened at 1:30 a.m., and she called the cops at 2:30. I think it was 2:30 p.m. is when she called the cops.
Okay, well, there's supposed to be a 12-hour cooling-off period.
Correct.
But they arrested you 13 hours after the claimed incident.
Mm, yep.
Okay.
So,
and who was it who made the decision to arrest? Was it a supervisor?
Sergeant Cricket of the Domestic Violence Detail. That's her name. She pretty much made the final decision that she.
Okay, so it wasn't anybody on patrol.
No, it was an actual detective from detective. Because usually, when an officer is involved, they bring out internal affairs. They bring out the DV detail. They bring out everybody. your, you know, the watch commander, the captain, lieutenants, everybody comes
in. Right. Who was the highest ranking officer on scene?
My captain was there, Todd Fasulo. He was there.
Now, was a captain, was this a weekday or a weekend?
It was a weekday. It was a Friday? I think it was a Friday.
So he was normally working then anyhow. The captains are usually working 9 to 5 sort of deal.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So everybody and their mother was there. Every Metro officer I could think of was there. And there was actually a bunch of people, a friend of mine who, I'm not going to name her name, but she even showed up and she was like, dude, she's going crazy in there. Your ex-girlfriend's going crazy in there. You know, she's like, oh, all these officers, you know, they know him and they're going to side with him. And she's inside CVS blown up. That's
right.
What I found out. I'm like, okay. So they do their investigation. I tell them my side of the story. She tells them their side of the story.
Did you show them the text messages back
and
forth?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Was this before you got booked?
Yeah, this is way before it.
During the investigation?
I am in the car doing a taped interview with the detectives. And I'm like, look, read the thing. It says, I know you're bringing me my stuff. That's her telling me. And I have a message to her saying, I'm bringing you your stuff. So I'm like, look, she knows. So, yeah, they made the decision to arrest me. I went down to jail. And then...
Now, they didn't put you into a holding cell, GP. What did they do? Hold you in a separate cell or something?
I went into the releasing area of the jail, away from everybody.
Right.
And I just kind of, like, chilled out there for a little while. I fell asleep inside a cell, but, I mean, it wasn't... There was nobody else around, so I just passed out on the bench for a little while. Cause it's a mandatory hold for a little while.
Now, is your heart racing at this point? It's like, my God, this is my career. What's going on?
I mean, I'm sitting in the parking lot going, you know what? I just don't want to lose my job. You know, I don't want to go to jail because look, I did nothing wrong. You know,
hey, we're talking what a year or so worth of testing and everything until you get offered the job.
Right.
Then you got to wait for the academy. And then you got, what,
six months for
the academy? Yep. Wow, you're lucky. I'm lucky. I did it in 4. We had 16 weeks.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So 6 months for the academy, several more months, another 4 months at least for field training.
Mm-hmm.
And then another year till you're off probation,
Pretty much.
You were within a month of being off probation, it sounds like, with
yes,
6
was.
Weeks. And this goes down.
Yep. My thing is like... So I get arrested and all this stuff, and then now it starts the process of non-confirmation is what they call it because I was a PO1. They go through this process. Instead
that PO1 means you're on probation.
Yeah, I'm on probation.
And until you become a PO2, you don't get civil service protection. You work at the leisure or work at the pleasure of the sheriff.
Right. Correct.
So you don't qualify for any sort of civil service protection. So for whatever reason, they can just say you're non-confirmed. We're not going to bring you back.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to hold off right there because we're about to head into the break here.
No problem.
And when we come back from the next segment, what we're going to do is find out. What the actual charges were for the arrest, what they told you at time of arrest, what sort of suspension paid or unpaid they put you on,
right.
And what happened with the girlfriend. As I understand, she made follow-up statements contradictory to her initial statements, but
yes.
Metro didn't listen to it.
Right.
All right, guys. Well, DJ, just stick around for a minute, buddy. We'll be back right after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in live right here to 2A Radio.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
Hi, guys. Welcome back from the break. Again, just to catch up, we're sitting here with DJ Pichot, who's working for Las Vegas Metro as a patrol officer. We're up to the point where you had gotten arrested based on the statements that your kind of, I guess we should say, estranged girlfriend of sorts,
right.
Kind of girlfriend, kind of not, was kind of like ex-girlfriend, current roommate, had made. Now, curiously, was there any sort of physical evidence to back up her 13-hours-old claim that there was any sort of domestic violence?
The only thing she had on her was a mark on her hand. She had like a cut where she said that I ripped the keys out of her hand. But even like myself through training experience, it was a puncture wound. It wasn't a scratch mark like she's claiming. It looked like she fell maybe on her keys and her keys went into her hand.
Now, did the night before, straight up, did you guys have any issue with the keys that night?
No. No, she can have her damn car keys. I don't care, you know. Like, no, there's no issue with no keys.
Okay. So,
and then she had on her arm, it's funny, on her left arm she had a mark, a bruise on her arm, which later on in like my internal affairs interview, it was determined that there was cuts over the bruises in the pictures that she admitted to cutting her arm 2 days prior to all of this even happening, like me and her fighting.
Okay.
So we're sitting there going, well, how do you get cuts over the bruises at work and then claim that I grabbed you, you know, by the arm and threw you to the ground? You know, the bruises were all faded. The bruises were all faded, and there was cuts over it. So it's like, no, that doesn't happen. But she used the mark on the hand, and she used the bruise on the arm to say that I you know, the battery occurred.
Okay.
So I got arrested for battery, domestic violence, and then auto burglary was what it was. They determined it to be auto burglary, that I broke into the car and stole her purse.
Even though you had a key to the car.
Even though I had a key to the car.
That she had given to you.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's what I got arrested for.
Now, curiously, are these charges still outstanding?
I actually have court coming up for them. So,
for both?
Yeah, it's still pending right now.
So they haven't dropped any of these charges?
Well, that's the funny thing. I've heard from other officers. I haven't heard from Metro, per se, but I've heard from officers. Like, even on a Channel 8 News website, they have their little blog.
The local CBS affiliate.
Right, there's even somebody that says she has made the claim to Metro that she wants nothing to do with this anymore, that she made all this up, that she knew I was a cop, and she just wanted me to, you know, to get in trouble for kicking her out of my house. There's all these claims I keep hearing about this stuff.
Now, when was the last time you and she actually spoke?
I haven't spoken to her since all this even happened.
Okay, because there's a restraining order involved?
There was. That's over with. I actually have one against her now.
It's a TPO,
yeah,
then?
Yeah.
So, okay.
I have one.
So she took out a TPO on you.
Yep.
When you were arrested.
Yeah, that night. And I actually got it signed in jail.
That expired.
Yep.
And then you took one out on her.
Yes. And the reason for that was because the where she lives and where my sister goes to school are pretty close, and I don't want, you know, to show up at my sister's school to pick her up and say, hey, he's harassing me and crap.
Right.
So I just got a TPO, or I got a protection order against her, so we wouldn't have any of those issues.
Okay, so, now, curiously, what happened with all of her crap that was in your apartment and in your truck?
She's still in my apartment to
this day. She's what?
She's actually still in my apartment to this day.
Where are you living?
My parents right now.
You can't. You're not allowed to go back?
No, I'm not.
So, even with the TPO she doesn't have against you, you have against her, but the apartment's in your name?
The lease was in my name. Now all the bills are in her name, I found out, because I shut everything that was mine off.
All right.
She had nothing in her name, period. No, the lease was in mine. All the bills were in mine. She was just staying there. Now
the lease is still in your name?
Now the lease is still in my name, but she has all the bills in her name because I shut everything off.
Oh, well, have you considered going in and saying I'm moving out?
Well, that's just it. My lease is over in June for this whole thing.
So you're just going to let it ride out?
Oh, yeah, and if she doesn't pay the rent, then they'll evict her, so I don't care. I'll pay the rent because I don't want that credit problem with me.
Right.
You know, but, yeah.
So you're paying her rent?
She's actually paying the rent. She actually paid April, so we'll see if she pays May. I don't know yet.
Now,
so,
curiously, what about all of your crap? Where's your stuff, your possessions?
We moved everything out. As soon as I got out of jail the next day, I went there with officers and...
Okay, so you have nothing there?
Nothing there is
mine. All you have there to worry about is your credit?
Yep.
Okay, gotcha. Yep. All right, I gotcha. So now... You go to jail, there's some sort of waiting period or another, you get released, and do they put you on suspension without pay, with pay, pending an investigation? What is it? And who tells you about the suspension?
That night that I got arrested, they put me on leave with pay. As soon as I got out of jail, I got put on leave without pay.
And so that was like 12 hours later?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, it was about 3 days later, maybe.
3 days later.
Yeah, so and that was done by my captain, Todd Fasulo.
Did he make the decision, or is he the one that told you?
You know what? I don't even know how the decision-making process
I'm sure the decision came from higher.
Yeah, because, I mean, everybody kept me out of the dark. I still can't even get people to answer my phone calls to this day.
Right.
So I don't know who made
the decision. And that's the way Metro operates. It's the way it operated 15 years ago when your sheriff was my lieutenant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got put on leave without pay. Then I got put on I was given the okay to use my vacation time. So I was on leave without pay, but I was being paid with my vacation hours.
You were cashing out your vacation.
Yeah, that I've accumulated. Okay. So I'd at least be still getting a check.
Okay, so what happens with all of this investigation? They probably take a couple of weeks, start bringing in internal affairs.
It's been 6 weeks.
It had been 6 weeks before you heard a thing.
It has been 6 weeks.
Oh, it has
been
6 weeks.
Since everything started to now, it's been about 6 weeks.
Okay, so from the time it happened till the day you get from the night you got taken to jail until they started investigating, started calling
a
you
week.
A week. Okay, that's pretty quick for Metro, actually, internally.
And then that was it. I didn't hear anything from them at all. And the only phone calls I've ever gotten was from the captain saying, hey, you need to come down and sign this, or hey, you need to come down and do this. But other than that, I was kept in the dark the whole time.
Okay, and you had a non-confirmation hearing about 10 days ago?
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
Who sat in on that?
That was myself, my union representative.
And who was that?
I had Mark Shapirian, but now I had Tom Reed. Tom Reed was his
okay.
name. The one that sat in on that thing.
Okay.
My captain Fasulo, and Deputy Chief Lombardo, Joe Lombardo.
Okay.
So, and it was very informal. It was just us sitting around a table.
Yeah, and as I understand, it's always a deputy chief who sits in on these hearings.
Yeah.
And it's never one of the deputy chiefs that's over patrol. It's always a deputy
right.
chief from another section. You know what section he was from.
Yeah, I don't know what section he's from.
Okay.
So I just know he was not in my chain of command.
Okay.
So we had our meeting. We had our talks. I made a mistake, and I even admitted up to it. I actually ran her on our systems, but that was like a long time. Like, I was even in field training when I ran her.
Oh, and they found that?
Yeah, they
looked
that.
Back?
Yeah, they found that. And they used that misuse of department resources, conduct them to becoming an officer, which is like a catch-all, I guess.
Right, and which what was it specifically that was the conduct?
Violating criminal law.
And which criminal law did you violate?
I don't know yet. Domestic violence and auto burglary.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's the only thing they have.
Okay.
They said that I violated the protection order when I got out of jail. I showed up at the residence and waited for the cops to show up. They're saying that I violated the protection order.
By having them stand by?
No, but beforehand. Like, I showed up at the residence before I called them.
Okay.
And they're saying that I violated the protection order. But I mean,
well, that's not up to the police to decide. That's
right.
up to the district attorney.
Of course.
Okay.
And they're using that also with violating of criminal law. So, I got terminated because I decided to fight the non-confirmation hearing, because I was given the option to resign or go ahead and fight it. So I showed up. I was like, I'm going to fight this because I didn't do nothing wrong.
Yeah, good for you.
So I show up and I you know, plead my case and tell them what I think, and they asked me questions and I answered them. And I was called back Monday, actually this week, saying, nope, the sheriff approved your non-confirmation and you're being terminated. So, and that's where I stand.
And this is the same sheriff that actually at some point in time went over the airways and talked about your case.
I heard about that. I don't know what he said. I heard he did, though.
Okay. You haven't actually heard what it was?
I have not. No, not
yeah,
yet.
I would really like to actually know what that was all about.
I had a friend of mine actually called me and told me about that and was like, dude, he should not have said anything. He doesn't know crap.
Well, and you know, actually, this sheriff, Sheriff Doug Gillespie of Las Vegas Metro, current sitting sheriff, he's in his second term, first year of his second term, and he has a history of going on the air and talking to the press about stuff that ends up being absolutely wrong. Case in point, and we're actually headed up on the break here, but case in point was about where the one cop about a year and a half ago was driving, maybe 2 years ago, driving
the DUI.
110 miles an hour down Flamingo in the middle of the night, and that he said, oh yeah, absolutely, he was rolling code.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Then they found out that he wasn't rolling code.
Yep.
And it's been about a dozen of these things. All right, guys, okay. Stay tuned. There's more to come after the break. We'll be right back. If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
That's right. Leave the damned firearms to us. You know, it's funny. I'm sitting here. We just started this segment. And as I do this, I have my phone in front of me and I keep some notes on it. And my girlfriend calls. She knows I'm doing a show.
She calls in the middle of it.
Anyhow. All right, I'm sorry, DJ. Let me turn your mic back on.
No problem.
Here we are. So they're doing the investigation. Now, I would imagine that the investigators probably spoke to, what's this girl's name?
Tiffany Nelson.
Okay, so they talked to Tiffany.
Yep.
And you have no idea what happens in the investigation.
Right.
All you know is you've heard, as I understand this, tell me if I'm wrong, from multiple sources that she's recanted and said, I just did this to get back at him.
Right.
The old hell hath no fury like a woman scorned.
Right. Yeah.
And in the wake of these things, the wake of all of her BS, that Metro said, well, you violated this, that, and the other.
Right.
But all in the wake of everything else, which they taught you about in the academy, is fruits of the poisonous tree.
Yes.
She starts hanging out the bad apple, and the serpent hangs the apple, and then everything after that is just downhill. So even with all this, they just decide they don't want the headaches out of you. And Gillespie's out there talking during the investigation.
Right.
The sheriff, he's running his mouth on the air about the case. It gets back to you. I'd like to hear what it is. But
me too, yeah.
It's interesting because, Doug Gillespie, as we talked when we were leaving for the commercial this last break, that he has a history of just running off the mouth about number of things.
Oh, yeah.
And there's also been, there's plenty of dirt on the higher-ups at Las Vegas Metro.
Oh, yeah.
So it's very hypocritical. You got a young guy who's never had any trouble. You're a member of the LDS Church.
Yep.
You've never had any sort of problem or criminal background or anything.
It's funny. The first thing my captain said when asked like what my record is for the department, he said he's never been in trouble, never had a statement of complaint, never had anything. High marks, or I have a lot of people write. What do they call?
You're talking about letters of commendation
from
citizens,
supervisors,
and citizens.
I have yet to have anything wrong on my record as a cop.
In about two, which is better than I had.
Yeah, in about 2 years.
Heck, I had a couple of car accidents.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, so let's sum this up just a little bit. We're talking about guys that are higher up than you.
Yes.
That allegedly have a little bit of dirt on themselves.
Oh, yeah.
But yet they're taking you out.
Yep. I do know, like, back in 2010, it's alleged that, even Captain Hank, there's all kinds of stuff on the internet about it. Dude was on drugs, allegedly, you know, beat his wife, strangled his wife, and shared.
Now, even I heard about that.
Yeah,
I heard about the captain allegedly putting his hands around the throat of his wife, and when Metro was called, they showed up, and from what I understand from some officers who were on the scene that I heard this through, was he made a statement somewhere along the line of, you can't arrest me, I'm a captain, and I outrank you.
Oh, yeah.
As if, okay, I'm higher in the law enforcement community, which means I can break more laws than you can.
Yep.
So evidently, you being a PO1, the lower part of the totem pole, you can't even
run a stop sign. Even like the sheriff himself. I mean,
there's a lot of alleged dirt on him.
Yeah, you know, shooting at his wife allegedly. On a DV and stuff.
Yeah, when he lived in Henderson.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I heard about this years ago, or it wasn't even that long ago, but where there was an event number by Henderson PD because he lived in Henderson, and that event number and everything there just vanished.
Yep, disappeared. I heard through other officers that actually showed up on that, because I actually know one of the cops that showed up on his DV.
DV meaning domestic violence,
yeah,
so those who were there.
Yeah, domestic violence. Said that he opened the door and was like, you can't arrest me. Only the district attorney in the corner can, and closed the door.
That's absolutely incorrect.
I'm like, really? You know,
a private citizen can arrest your dumbass.
I'd have walked in the house and been like, nope, you got it, you know, domestic violence, you're going to jail. You know, so... I mean, there's all kinds of allegations with higher-ups, but they're higher-ups, and they just sweep it on under the table.
Exactly.
Who cares?
Yeah. Membership has its privileges.
Yep. I have a friend of mine who was like, the only reason why they fired you was for budget cut purposes. So instead of firing a bunch of cops, they just find problems with them and get rid of them.
You know, I've heard that before. I just don't buy into that.
Yeah.
Because they had probably a good couple $100,000 in training in you.
Yep.
And you don't just... You just don't let that go.
Oh, yeah.
You just don't do that.
No, you don't.
What you do is you take some of the older guys and say, okay, it's time for you to retire.
Right.
So, and that's young. I mean, you're 24 years old, mm-hmm. Which is a great time in the eyes of the police department to actually get people to start up. You've got a long career ahead of you.
Right.
You're in good shape. You could have easily done anything, gone to K-9 or SWAT or right. whatever you wanted to from there. You're bright. You could have easily made rank and moved up. But the thing is when there's a little bit of egg that leaks out of the shell,
right.
Metro just has the habit of allowing it to land on their own face, and then they try to save what little bit of that face
yes.
is left. So if Gillespie gets on the radio before any non-confirmation hearing happens and starts talking about it yeah. in a negative light, how does he go back a month or two later when he's the one ultimately responsible for looking
right.
at the non-confirmation hearing and making the decision?
Yeah.
How can he go back later and say, yeah, as it turned out, all of those allegations were false and I was wrong. Officer Pasciotta has been reinstated.
Yeah. I mean, then that's what I don't get. He goes on the radio and says all this, and then he, like a couple days later, signs by non-com, which is like, well, you already had your mind made up before you even heard everything? Or how does that work out? You know, that's one thing that got me from
yeah.
him making all these comments.
Well, what's your next move?
I don't know right now. I got to finish this court thing in May for these charges, which there's no evidence, you know, so I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go. I'm hoping they just drop everything at the prelim.
If nothing else, they have to do proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right,
I'll tell
exactly.
you something to expect. If Metro has lousy trumped up charges
right.
that they can't seem to get through a preliminary, oftentimes what they do is right at the end, they end up getting rid of the preliminary and sending
right.
it to a grand jury.
Right.
So if they do that, that means their case is very weak.
Yes.
Yeah. But that does mean you have to go to trial, Jared,
right.
because
and then, yeah.
yeah, usually those
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So just we'll see how that goes.
Yep.
What about work? Are you working right now?
Not yet, cuz I just found out that my last day was the 18th. So not yet. My last check I'll be receiving it May 6th. And then after that, after all this stuff, I'll go get me a job back and try to find something to do.
So, what did you do before you were cop?
I was actually in Italy for 2 years on my mission for my church.
Okay.
So I came home and immediately joined the force.
Living in sin. Did you learn anything when
yeah,
you were on your mission,
I messed
man?
Up. I messed up. I did.
Wow.
There was a few things I did that was messed up. So
that's right. You're living right there, man. Dog pound. That's cool.
Trying to work out things.
I live in sin on a somewhat regular basis in my life. I got to tell you, they say treat your body like a temple, and sometimes I just have to treat it like an amusement park. I actually took that line from the movie SWAT. Anyhow, but that's just the way it goes. So I got to tell you, man, this stinks.
Mm-hmm.
You are by far not the first person this has happened to.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You will absolutely not be the
last. Exactly.
And it doesn't matter who's in charge. And here's the interesting thing. A lot of people don't know this. Las Vegas Metro used to be the county sheriff's office in
right.
the city of Las Vegas. In 1973, they merged to Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. They do the city of Las Vegas and unincorporated Clark County.
Right.
Which is a huge area. 65,000 square miles in Clark County. Very, very large county. And every single sheriff in the history of Las Vegas Metro has come from within.
Oh, yeah.
There's never been a sheriff elected outside of the department.
Yep.
And they've all basically been anointed by the previous sheriff.
Yeah.
I even remember years ago when Sheriff Jerry Keller was leaving, he said, I'm not going to choose sides because the two finalists, one of them was his deputy chief, one of his deputy chiefs, and the other one was his former sheriff when he was on the department and young. And he later, actually towards the end of the election, endorsed his deputy chief
right.
over the former sheriff,
yeah,
going back on his word. Oh, yeah. Imagine that. So,
it's usually how it works, too.
Yeah, it's who they decide, all right, we're going to sit around a command staff meeting,
yep.
deputy chiefs and above, and who wants to be sheriff?
There's definitely rumors floating around even now for the next one after Gillespie leaves.
Yeah, who's that?
So, I cannot remember their names. But
one of the deputy chiefs
or
something?
Yeah, one of the deputy chiefs, yeah, the higher-ups.
Who's definitely. The undersheriff right now?
Rudd, no, I don't know. I don't know who it is.
You don't know who the undersheriff is?
I don't keep up with that crap.
Whoever it is was directly in your chain of command.
Exactly. So, no, me, I just show up to work, I do my job, and I go home. That's usually how I did things. You know, I don't care about all the politics and crap that are involved at Metro.
And there's a lot of them.
That's all it is.
There's a lot of them.
So,
and I got to tell you, one of the things that drove me absolutely up the wall was working with the liability cops. They won't
yes.
do, oh, I'm not going to do that because I could be liable. I won't
yep.
do that. So you do basically nothing but respond to calls for service.
Yeah.
And you respond to calls for service. You don't do very much there because you're worried about liability
yep.
and getting sued.
Getting in trouble and yeah. Oh, yeah.
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And these are the people that last a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
And
the
guys like you and me
yes.
leave.
Yep. I mean, the squad I was on right before I left, we didn't answer calls for service. Our job was basically go and clean up the strip. We got all the, you know, the people that need to go to jail. We got them off the strip and took them to jail.
So you were a utility squad.
That's all we did. And we had so many felony arrests a night. Our squad alone had at least 5-6 felony arrests a night, which is a lot. Large amounts of, you know, drugs and guns and all kinds of stuff.
On the Las Vegas Strip?
On the Las Vegas Strip. Oh, there's okay. A lot of them.
So you're keeping it safe.
That's what we were trying to do. And you know what? Our squad was working, and that's all we did. We didn't care about what everybody else thought. We just did our job.
Did you have a sister squad for the days you were off?
No, we did not.
Okay.
We did not.
So, but you worked the weekends.
Yeah. Yeah, we worked. We went in Thursday night and got off Monday morning.
There you go.
So
that's when Vegas is hopping.
Yep.
So. Good. Well, DJ, thanks for coming in, man.
Thank
I'm
going to
shake your hand right here.
It.
I know they can't see it, but yeah. I appreciate you coming in and telling your story and getting an opportunity to put it out there.
Yeah.
Because the other side was put out there, and the other side was put out there when it's supposed to be fair and impartial.
Right.
When it happened before any decision was made, which means it couldn't possibly have been fair and impartial.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which right there, actually, you could offer up some sort of a civil suit.
I'm trying to.
Yeah. Good thinking.
I just can't get nobody to answer a phone call, so I've been trying.
Well, the only person you need to answer a phone call is a good attorney.
Good attorney,
good attorney, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So.
All right, and call the mayor's office. He's about to leave, and he's an attorney.
Going to, yeah, actually. Good. That's my next call.
All right. Thanks very much, DJ.
Thank
Guys,
you.
Stay tuned. During hour two coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about the precision rifle course of last week. We're going to have Eric Severson of the Appleseed Project coming in to help finish up the show. So we'll be back right after this break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
All right, guys, welcome back. So last weekend, we did the Bill Carnes 3-day precision rifle course. It was Friday, April 15th through Sunday, April 17th. Goals of the course were to collect data every 50 yards out to 1,000 and beyond. And we completed just about every goal we had set. We got to 1,000. We didn't get beyond on paper. And part of that was people were just plain running out of adjustment on their scopes on some of the guns. Now, it's interesting. Beforehand, everybody who signed up, I'm sending out emails with a lot of information on them, somewhat lengthy emails. And some of them had links to other pages on the site that were a little bit hidden with some welcome information and information we needed to gather. And, of course, there was 5 or 6 people that didn't read all of that information. Hey, I'm signed up. I just need to grab my stuff and go. Those same 5 or 6 people were the ones who didn't have the right scope base or had an issue with their pack or their bipod or didn't bring a squeeze bag. A lot of the stuff that they needed to know, all of the information that they needed, they didn't read because they didn't go through all the information. So anyhow, you always get that with the percentage of the population. Those folks struggled a little bit in some areas, but still we got some good results. One of the stars was actually a guy that came in from New Jersey. And I've always been a proponent of, look, bring a gun that's a decent gun. Bring a scope that's a decent scope. Bring ammo that's decent ammo. And we'll get you doing as good as we possibly can with what you bring. Just don't bring a totally terrible gun or a completely crappy $50 optic out of Walmart or handloads of some sort of old military ball garbage. Don't do that. You know what I mean? At least put a little effort into it. One of the guys came with a Saiga 308 semi-automatic based on a Kalashnikov AK style action, chambered 308, about a $300 gun. He put a super sniper scope on it, which is just fine, about a $300 scope. And then he brought Pervy Partisan ammo, which is, several people brought that, the 175 grain. It was a full metal jacket boat tail match ammo. Now, most of the time, match ammo has a hollow point, but this stuff from Pervy, that when you get the 175 grain, is an FMJ. The hollow points, they still have in the 168 grain. So a lot of people brought the 175s. Gives you a little bit further distance, a little bit extra reach. So this guy had a $40 bipod that he bought at Walmart after day two that he wanted to have for day three. Put all this together, he had about $1,000 invested in gear and ammo. And this guy, with a non-precision rifle that we set up the day before the class started on Thursday, set up several guns with bases and rings and scopes and getting eye relief set up. And we did, it was probably 7 or 8 straight hours of work on a bunch of people's guns, getting them all set up, barrels lapped and honed and everything. This guy's gun was one of them. He had hits on paper at every single distance. About 2 minutes of angle, which means at 400 yards, about an 8-inch group. At 1,000 yards, about a 20-inch group. We are shooting at targets that were 24 inches wide by 36 inches tall with a target area on there that was 20 inches in circle. We had basically, it was a big reticle printed on the target and then an MOA graph paper in the center. And this particular guy from New Jersey had hits at every single distance the first time. Some people weren't getting their dopes adjusted quite right for the distance. We had some X-ball and ballistic calculator sheets, but those work just so well out to certain distances, and then they just fall off. And you have to actually find out what you've got. But anyhow, it went really well. We got a lot of data. Then at the end of day three, after lunch on day three, we took the bigger guns up on a bluff, and we set up some 55-gallon drums at 1 mile, which is 1,760 yards. 1,760 yards a mile away up on a bluff. We had a couple of 50-caliber rifles out there. We had a, I forget the brand of it. There was just a single-shot bolt-action BMG, 50 BMG. There was a Barrett M82A1, the shorter barreled, 20-inch barreled one. We had one of the guys out there with a 300 Win Mag that had a U.S. optic on it, which, by the way, for my opinion, they are expensive. U.S. optics are expensive, but they're worth the money. He had about a $2,600 scope on it, and U.S. optics probably, in my opinion, makes the best scopes in the world today. We had one of the guys who was shooting a 300 Winchester Short Magnum, another guy with a 7mm Winchester Short Magnum, all of them getting hits at 1 mile. Some of them very generous, offering some ammo to let guys get out there and shoot. The guy with the Saiga 308, he decided to pull his 308 out, and using mil dot holdover, got hits at a barrel at 1,500 yards, which is well beyond the standard capability of a 308, but got repeated hits with that, with a traditionally non-precision rifle that was shooting quite precisely. A lot of the guys brought the, I sent out a link for 50 caliber ammo, and they bought the American Eagle 660 grain. And once we got the BMGs, the 50s, set up to, you know, dialed in with that particular round, guys were just dialing it in and hitting these barrels at a mile. It was a lot of fun. It was really great. And we actually had quite a bit of crosswind. We had crosswinds down towards the target, gusting at about 20 to 23 miles an hour. Not too much up on the bluff, a little bit of a breeze, but we had a full value crosswind with 20 to 23 mile an hour gusts with a constant of about 12 to 14 miles an hour, and able to overcome that without too much adversity. As a matter of fact, I sat down behind the guy's 300 Win Mag, calculated the wind, dialed everything in, a little bit of mil dot holdover, and hit a 55-gallon drum at 1 mile with this gun, first round, first hit. So I ejected the round, closed the bolt up, closed up the scope covers, put the safety on, and stood up. And they said, oh, shoot some more. You got a hit. My response was, why would I do that? Mission's done. One shot, one hit, you're done. So they all applauded that. They thought that was a pretty good way of getting it done. So anyhow, it was a very good class. What we're looking to do for the next class, for a follow-up to this, is to put all of the data that was gathered out to 1,000 yards into use and start getting some range estimation, doing a little bit of field craft, learning a little bit about target identification and target selection. That would be the second course. The third course would be all about field craft and mission specific. So it'd be one of these deals where the third course of this series will probably be something along the lines of bring 40 rounds of ammunition for the 3-day course, because we're going to sight in and confirm, and then you're going to be given mission specific deals or mission specific information to handle for the next half day or full day or maybe even overnight. We might actually run the thing overnight and make it a more inclusive sort of a thing for stalking and hunting. Can be used in the field, can be used for game hunting, can be used you know, for whatever purpose you're going to need a long-range precision rifle for. So that's what we're looking at for basically the 202 and the 303 courses. 101 is done. And I want to thank everybody that came out. We had a total of 26 students come out and participate. One of them, his gun broke. It went down. A retaining pin on his firing pin went down in his Browning semi-auto. Everybody else got some trigger time in. A couple people left a little early due to other commitments. But for the most part, everybody stuck around and got a lot of good data. So, anyhow, there you go. After the break, we're going to come back, have Eric Severson with the Appleseed Project to sit in. And we're going to shoot the breeze a little bit then. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
And welcome back from the break. I would like to welcome Eric Severson with the Appleseed Project for sitting in. Eric, how the heck are you?
Great, Bill. How are we doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, man. Now, you're in town, actually in Pahrump, doing a little bit of your own gun trees. Matter of fact, you and I were out on the range earlier sighting in a couple of guns. I was doing a couple 30-30s, and you got yourself a brand new AK-47 to play with.
Yes, very so, fun.
Yeah, that was a good gun, man. Good
first
gun.
Time I really ran that rifle, and I really liked it.
Good. Now, you're with the Appleseed Project, but not necessarily here at the show on their behalf. But talk to us a little bit about Appleseed. We've talked about it before on the show, but now that we have a weekend format, we have some new listeners. So
sure.
Talk about the Appleseed Project, what you guys do, things like that.
What Appleseed is, we're a nationwide nonprofit organization. We teach fundamental rifle marksmanship. We teach whatever gun you bring out, whatever rifle, you'll get better at it before you leave. What sets us apart from other shooting instruction is we also cover some of the heritage of the country. We talk in detail about the events of April 19, 1775, which 236-year anniversary of that was just a couple days ago. And we talk about what happened on that day and about the brave patriots that stood up in the face of King George's professional army. That time, the greatest army that ever walked the face of the earth, and a bunch of farmers and shopkeepers and blacksmiths, pretty good whipping on them. And that was the day the Revolutionary War actually started. So we like to talk about that and connect people back to their heritage.
That's awesome. Now, I got to tell you, Eric, a guy that's he's now a mutual friend of both of ours, but I knew him a little before that, a guy by the name of Scott, who's he was the other 30-30 I was sighting in today. We'll do some shooting this weekend, the three of us. But Scott asked me if I was interested in going to an Appleseed shoot about 18 months ago out in Boulder City, Nevada, about an hour and a half from where he and I live here in Pahrump. And I said, sure. You know what the heck? It's $70 for the weekend. Unless, I think, if you're a kid or a woman or a cop or in military, then it's all free. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. So you guys are gender biased, as I like to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you have indoor plumbing, then it's free. If you have outdoor plumbing and you're not either a cop or in the military or under 18 years old, then you got to pay.
That's right.
Thanks, by the way.
I ain't got quite that figured out yet either, but...
Yeah, you're not the one making the decisions.
No.
A little bit closer to the mic.
Man. Oh, yeah, no.
You don't have to actually rest your nose on the back of it or anything, but there you are. So, anyhow, I went out to this shoot. I mean, I have been to countless rifle courses, and I've taught 20 times more than I've taken. And usually when I take a course, it's a matter of I'm going to learn what not to do as opposed to anything useful. At this particular level, I don't mean to sound like a pompous ass, but it's just the way it goes. You know, it's like you don't take somebody who's been racing cars for a long time. You don't teach them too often. If they go to driving school, oftentimes they realize, yeah, let's not do that. But when I went out to Appleseed, there was really no occurrence of that. And in fact, I actually learned a couple of things. And I was very pleasantly, not just surprised, but impressed with not only the teaching, because you were the shoot boss that weekend.
Right.
And then you had a couple of the other guys with you that were helping out, the instructors, who were both good. Not only with you guys, but the format as a whole. And I have since recommended to the vast majority of people that want to learn how to shoot a rifle, start with Appleseed. because it's going to be at its most expensive, $70, and for a large population of the large percentage of the population is going to be free. You get your 2 days, and there's no reason you can't repeat it, because Appleseed tends to repeat at least quarterly any place that they teach.
It, a lot of it depends on population. We're in the Vegas area, we alternate. We're alternating Clark County Shooting Park and Boulder City this year. We're taking off July and August because it's just going to be too hot. But there's going to be 10 months, 10 shoots in Vegas
every month
this year.
Yeah. Every month. Now, you're from the smaller area of Ridgecrest, California, in Kern County.
Right.
And how many shoots do you guys do there per annum?
Right now, we're doing 2 a year, but we're going to get it up to 3 or 4.
Okay. So anywhere you go, there's probably going to be at least one, maybe a couple. And
right.
It might even be 2-3-4 hour drive, and you can do a weekend. And Appleseed's just really good. And how long have you been with Appleseed, Eric?
I went to my first shoot in May of 08, and I started becoming an instructor in January of 09.
Okay, so 3 years ago, roughly,
about
you got introduced.
Yeah. Yes.
And, 2.5 years ago, you actually jumped on board.
Right.
Okay.
I knew I wanted to be an instructor at my first Appleseed, but you have to shoot the rifleman score before you can become an instructor. So it took me 2 Appleseeds to do that.
Good.
I got you. I got it done.
And, you know, it's interesting. The first time I ever took a formalized shooting class, I took the Gunsight 250 class, the handgun class, in October of 1994. October, as a matter of fact, Halloween Day was day number one. It went through November 5th. And during that course, I told myself, someday, I want to be to the level where I can teach a class like that. And, in fact, I got to that level and well beyond with all the different weapon systems and advancements in the techniques and tactics. And I got to tell you, I know exactly what you're talking about when you're dealing with Appleseed, with your experience there. So that's really pretty stand-up.
As I remember when you came out to that Appleseed, I printed off the sign-in sheet off the website the day before. I'm looking and I see Bill Carnes. I'm like, wow. You were my instructor at my first front sight course. And I'm like, I know this. I better have my A game going this weekend if this guy's going to be here.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because when Scott and I showed up, we drove out there together. And I get out and you guys greeted me with a warm, oh, you're Bill Carnes. And you greet you and I. Who was the other?
Chris.
Chris, yes. And the other instructor I didn't know, but you and Chris had taken a 4-day handgun course that I was range mastering maybe, I don't know, a year before that or something.
But yeah, my first front sight class was almost 3 years ago.
Okay. So anyhow, you greeted me with a very warm reception, and I was a little overwhelmed because occasionally when students are out, I mean, you're out there, you're doing your job, and you almost achieve like a miniature celebrity status of some sorts, and it's a bit much sometimes. But you guys were really nice. It's like, oh man, I heard you were going to be here, and this is great, and I got to tell, I was just impressed with you guys teaching that course as you ever could have been anything that I was teaching. I was
Thanks.
Really happy with that. I remember talking with you a little bit during some of the breaks about some of the terminology that Appleseed uses, such as the pull the trigger and or squeeze the trigger.
Squeeze.
And I got to tell you, for my 2 cents, squeezing a trigger is not what you do. To squeeze a trigger, if you had a trigger and you wrapped your hand around that trigger and squeezed, that'd be squeezing the trigger. It doesn't make a gun go off. The term I've used for many, many years has been press, because you're pressing it to the rear. You're not pulling it, and you're not squeezing it. But I understand, you know, that's terminology that comes from Appleseed, and you have to, you know, march to the beat of that particular drummer.
Right.
But I can tell you, some of the techniques that you use, the explanations, you used a little a stock that had a little laser on it that showed if you change a little thing here, a little thing there, where the laser moves on the little target just a yard or two in front of you, and how that is really enhanced the further you go down range. And just some very good teaching tools and very good explanation of how those things work. And different position shooting that you shoot from. And a lot of people are just bringing out 10-22s. And I know what you guys recommend, a couple of little modifications for them to make it a little more user-friendly, because you do some shooting under a little time pressure as you get into the course. Good marksmanship skills, just excellent stuff. Excellent stuff.
Thanks. Yeah, when Appleseed first started, in fact, even at my first Appleseed, it was mostly center fires on the line. M1As, Garands, ARs.
Yeah, I had a bolt action 308.
Yeah, Scott had his AR. But then with ammo prices, everybody started bringing 22s.
Yeah. Well, there you go. As a matter of fact, we're going to move on a little bit after this. You want to talk a little bit about reloading and hand loading?
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's what you guys can expect after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, with special guest Eric Severson sitting in here during hour two of 2A Radio. We'll be right back right after the break.
Right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
All right, guys, welcome back. Again, we have special guest Eric Severson in. Eric's with the Appleseed Project, but we already talked about that. So now, I'm going to talk a little bit about reloading, because that's a pretty popular thing to do, especially with ammo prices nowadays. The dollar is in the toilet, and with the dollar being in the toilet, that means everything costs more money, and ammo's certainly one of those things. Especially after the run on ammo that happened. I gotta tell you, Barack Obama was the best gun and ammo salesman in the history of this country.
Yeah, it was at Gun Owners of America. Gun Owners of America.
Wait, hold on. There you go.
Oh, yeah, Gun Owners of America voted him 2008 Gun Salesman of the Year.
Absolutely. Yeah,
my gun shop guy in town back in Ridgecrest, he's like, I can't stand this SOB, but boy, I've had my best
good
2 months
business.
I've ever had.
Yeah, good for business. Now, I don't really reload so much, I more hand load, and I hand load for very specific calibers. I do 22-250 because I have an electronic primer fired, it's a Remington 700 Etronics. I do 416 Remington Magnum because that ammo is between like $5 and $8 around. I do 308 precision ammo for my precision rifle. I do 30-30 just because the particular round that I buy, there's two different rounds that I like to shoot, and they're both really expensive, so I hand load for those. And I think that's about it. I have some of the stuff to actually do like 8mm French Lebel rifle. I have one of those, and then 7.5mm Schmidt, but I haven't actually loaded either of those. You actually do a fair amount of reloading.
Yes.
And I think your reloader of choice is a Dillon 650, if memory serves correct.
That's right.
Yeah. And recently, our mutual friend Scott got a brand new 650 and all the stuff. And one of my good friends, Jared Adams, came out to help me teach the precision rifle course last weekend. And he was out for about 10 days. Came out early, helped me get everything set up at the range, helped me teach, then helped me break everything down. And Jared's got three separate Marine Corps shooting records, a bunch of bench rest wins and trophies and things such as that, and probably one of the top two or three best natural shooters I've ever come across in my entire career. But, I mean, he's been shooting since he's a kid. Just lightning fast, incredibly accurate. Really knows his stuff. And he's also, he and his dad, when they did bench rest stuff, they were the type of guys that would, you know, measure every little thing on every single case. Everything that could be measured, and then they'd find other stuff to measure. They would water weigh their cases, and they would weigh out their primers, the cases, the bullets, the powder, every single little thing. So they'd load 20 rounds, which were virtually absolutely identical. And Jared once told me that it was an average of about an hour and 10, hour and 15 minutes spent per round to load it.
Wow.
Now, of course, you know, you're doing, you know, several casings, doing one step, and then you move on, you do another step, further separate things out. So he knows what he's doing. But Jared and I actually went over, and I'm not much of a progressive reloader guy. I have a rock chucker, and I also have a Lee single-stage press. I use the Lee only for case prep. I don't actually load anything on it. I don't find it to be as precise as I want, but the rock chucker's good. So we went over to Scott's house. He wanted to load up a bunch of ammo. We converted. He had 223 set up. We just set it up for some 30-30. And I got to tell you, man, when we got that thing working, it was humming. But there's a lot to that machine.
Yeah.
You know what you're doing. I don't know what it takes you, but I'm not familiar with the 650. Jared was not familiar with the 650. Although you had once showed Scott stuff, it was as he freely admitted, kind of in one ear out the other because he didn't really do anything with it. It took us nearly 4 hours to get that thing set up and moving. And you live about 3 hours away. It would have been easier to call you up and have you drive 3 hours and set the thing up for us.
Maybe.
I mean,
yeah.
What's it take for you to set up a one, like reset up for calibers?
Well, when I first got it, it would take me about an hour per caliber. But now,
when you first got it,
yeah,
it took three of us. Well, two of us, 4 hours.
Right. Well, you had to probably change the primer system, didn't you? The
we
primer
did.
Feed. That
we did.
Is
yeah,
a
from
absolute
small to large.
Pain in the butt. In fact, I got to the point where the only small primer round I reload for is 223. So I'm leaving that primer system on large primer because everything else I load is large primer, 45, 308, 30-06. So now...
So we have 8 man-hours to where you had one.
Yeah, but when I first time I changed the primer system, it took me over an hour.
Okay, so you had two hours.
Do you guys have the DVD for it?
We did, yeah.
Oh, okay. Did you watch it?
A little bit. No, seriously. I mean,
yeah.
But it's one of those things where... Like most guys, right? You can't teach us about guns, cars, and women, so we're not going to look at any of those manuals unless
sure.
something just isn't working.
I got you.
And there still isn't a good manual on women out there.
I mean, no, I don't think that one. I don't think that one exists, and I don't think it ever will exist.
They're all very unique, lovely, wonderful creatures,
oh,
aren't
yes.
they? Just as DJ Pastrota from the first hour.
Oh, yeah, that's yeah, pretty positive.
Anyhow, so yeah, it took us 8 man-hours to get this thing set up. We did look at the DVD a couple of times. Specifically, the primer system was one of them. And once we got it done, they were cranking out.
Oh, that thing gets humming. And they claim you can get 8 to 1,000 rounds an hour out of the 650.
800 to 1,000.
And I suppose you could, but for me, I like to look, you know, look in each case, make sure there's powder in there,
right.
And then, you know, make sure the bullet's seated right. And, you know, I'm not gonna, you could, I've seen a YouTube video where the guy, it may have been the 1150. The commercial reloader, where he actually sets up a like an air compressor and turns on the air compressor and just goes like this.
It's all automated.
Yeah, it's got the automatic bolt feeder and everything, and he's doing like 1,500 rounds an hour.
Yeah,
I just don't trust that enough. I need to like look inside the case. Okay, there's powder in there. I'm good.
Yeah, we ended up doing about 900 rounds, almost 1,000 rounds, and we probably had 3.5 hours on the press to do that. So what's that? About 270 an hour, and you know, because you got to reload the primers, you
sure.
got to you know reload the casings, and you know if there's an issue, you got to stop.
Yep.
And you know, quite honestly, Scott's machine was brand new, and it hasn't been broken in very well. There's just not much use on it, and like anything, you need it to break in, loosen up a little bit, things such as that. So. Anyhow, but I got to tell you, we pumped out a lot of ammo on there, and I ended up, one of the things that wouldn't work was I wanted to make sure that they were crimped with a 30-30 because it goes into a tube. So set the bullet where the cantilever is to the lip of the case mount,
right.
And then crimp it. But the thing is the crimp die that I had wouldn't work, and I like to have a separate crimp die. I don't like to really crimp with the bullet seater. So we got a little bit of a crimp with a bullet seater, but I like to have a separate crimp die. So what I ended up doing was I ended up, once all those were done, I took them home on my single-stage press, and I physically inspected every single round and crimped them. And of the roughly 930 or so that we loaded on that Dillon, I think there were 17 that had an issue. So it's a pretty accurate press.
Yeah, and that's not a Dillon die he's using either, is it? I think it's a Redding die.
Redding dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the crimp die that I had was actually a Lee crimp die.
That's the kind I used too.
Yeah. And it seemed like the rest of the dies that were that I had, like any of the Lee dies or a couple of the, I think it seems like only the Redding dies and the Dillon dies are actually long enough to fit in there.
That's true. That is correct.
Everything, it's like it'll still thread in there, but they're not long enough so you can't really do much
with
them.
Yeah, because my first reloading kit was a Lee 4 turret press. And it was an okay press. It kind of started falling apart after a couple of years, and people say, oh, they got to just send them the part back. I'm like, yeah, well, I'm in the middle of a loading session. I don't want to wait a week. I want it to last.
Yeah.
And I still use it for loading precision ammo. Mm-hmm. For my 308, I still use it for that. And it's really convenient because I took the shaft out of it, so you just – and then you got like your sizing die, and you just kind of turn it with your hand, and you go right to the to the seating die.
Oh, I got you. So you set it up as kind of a multi-pieced single-stage press.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And that's what I load my 308 precision ammo with.
Okay, good. And what's your 308 gun?
It's a Remington 700.
Yeah, kind of the gold standard right now.
Yeah, I got a sweet deal on it.
Good. All right, guys. Stay tuned. We're going to have more after the break. We're going to still have Eric Severson here. We're going to talk about a few other things after the break. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio. If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back on!
Hi, guys. Welcome back from the break. We still have special guest Eric Severson here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, we talked about Appleseed Project.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about hand loading and reloading. Now, let's go off of Second Amendment type of stuff, and let's talk a little bit about the movie. It's been out about a week now. I've yet to see it. The first of three films to depict the book Atlas Shrugged. Now, I'm a huge fan. You've recently read the book.
Yeah, I only first read the book, about 2 months ago. It's one of those books that have been on my list to read forever, but, again, it's one of those books you pick up, you see 1,200 pages, and you just don't
set it back down.
You just kind of go, maybe later. But I've had some extra time on my hands, so I figure, what the hell, I'll just go ahead and read this thing. And I actually read the whole thing in about 6 days. I just couldn't put it down. Once wow. I got into it, I just couldn't put it down.
It's a real page-turner.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome.
You know, it's interesting. I can't read at length. I really can't. If I might read 10, 15, 20 pages on the far outside, and I get tired. If I ever can't sleep, all I have to do is pick up a book and start, even if it's a good book. The last book that I read cover to cover was probably The Book of the Rifle.
I've got that book.
Yeah. From Jim Carmichael.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think I've read that. I've probably read that entire book, but I've read it in sections. I started at one and end. Like, I want to read what he says about windage. I want to see what he says about triggers.
That's the beauty of it, is compartmentalized. But Atlas Shrugged, I actually listened to it on audiobook about a year and a half ago. And you said you read 1,200 pages in 6 days. I would listen during road trips and stuff. It took me about 3 months to get through the entire thing. But I re-listened to a couple of different things. But for those of you who don't know, Atlas Shrugged, by a few accounts, has been purported to be said to be the most intellectually stimulating and important book in American society, second only to the Bible in the last 60 years. It is an incredible book. If you listen to the audiobook, it is 50 CDs.
Wow, that's a lot.
So it's a lot of CDs. So my CD player got burned out pretty good, but it's incredible. When I heard the movie was coming out, I was giddy. But you know, with this last weekend, we had the precision rifle course. A bunch of stuff I haven't gotten to because of this course. I'm actually thinking about going out and seeing a show tonight.
Cool.
Yeah. So if you're sounds welcome good. To jump, we're gonna we'll I'm gonna to go
see.
To Vegas.
Let's
so.
See what Scott's up to. See if he wants to
see if
head
he
back
has an interest.
Vegas.
Yeah.
See if he wants to head back there.
And he's actually about. He's.
Oh yeah, he's probably still in Vegas. He's working.
Yeah. He'll be on his way in from Vegas shortly.
We better call him when we get done here, real quick. Then.
Yeah. Yeah. See what he has to say. So.
Yeah, that book really makes you think. I mean, it gets down to kind of the base of your beliefs and values. You're going to find out what they are. I can't remember what person said it. If it was either Dagny or John, or maybe it was Francisco, but I can't think of that quote. But it was said something like, "If you have a conflict, just there really is no conflict. You know what you think and what you feel, and just go with that."
Yeah, if you have a conflict, there really is none.
Yeah,
because you're conflicting with what you believe to be the right thing, whether or not you should do that or do something
exactly.
that you know not to be the right thing.
It's the easy or the wrong thing, exactly.
Exactly.
So that book, I never read a fictional book that really just made me like stop and really think about what I just read.
It's interesting because although the book is fictional, it's based on things that have happened throughout history in other areas, and it was an application to American society back in the 1950s when Ayn Rand, a Russian immigrant, when she wrote it. And here's the thing that I'm really interested in. I figured it was going to be a period movie back in the 50s when it was written. But in fact, it's not. They've taken the period information and adapted the screenplay to modern times. And I went online and I saw many different promotional videos with it and some interviews from the director and some of the people in the cast. And I got to tell you, I am absolutely enthralled with being able to go see this thing. I am so looking forward to it, especially to see how they took period information and adapted it to modern life. I have heard from a couple of people who have seen it that it's done really well.
I tell you, I talked to one person that saw it, and they said they really liked it. And
this is the first of three. Well, you don't have a 1,200-page book and turn that into a two-hour movie.
Right. I was very happy when I found out it was three separate movies, except the fact we probably got to wait another year for part two, which kind of sucks.
Or longer.
But yeah, but at least they're going to do it right and not just shortchange it. And,
yeah, with bated breath, we hope.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, but, and that movie is fantastic. I really kind of liked I don't want to ruin anything in the book, but there was a scene towards the end of the book. It'll be in the last movie, I'm sure, where they actually get into a gunfight.
Yes.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a section, I don't know if it's in the movie.
There's a couple different gunfights.
There is, yeah. There is. There's a gunfight where people are starting to overrun. That'll probably be movie two. And then kind of the heroes of the story of sorts get into a gunfight towards the end and inside of a smaller room.
Right.
The other one is outdoors with a mob.
Yes.
So
that's right.
I'm looking to see what kind of guns they put in the hands of these guys because in a period piece in the 60s, you can guess there what it'd be. But modern times, what are they going to run? ARs, AKs, M1s.
Yeah. Probably ARs, maybe pistols, probably either a Glocks or 1911s.
Something like that, maybe an XD or something in there.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
But it's kind of weird when I was reading the book, it's really mirroring about where our country is right now with the government running things.
Isn't it unbelievable? Where the government takes
over. Yeah,
they
come up with all these weird, retarded-sounding names for these government organizations. It's like, this is happening right now.
Yeah.
Anybody doesn't know, basically the premise of the story is the people who produce, the producers of the country, the captains of industry who are vilified as evil, the government is just coming down on them, regulation. And what they basically do is just say, you know what? You don't want us. You don't like us. Fine. And
yeah,
they just stop working. And
they do. They disappear.
And then the government comes in and tries to take over these industries, and it just falls into disarray.
And these people literally disappear.
Yes.
And part of the book is what happens to them, why they're disappearing, and what goes on. That'll all be in the third movie. But I highly suggest the book. It is an absolute page-turner, as Eric said, or a CD changer, yeah. If you're listening to the audiobook.
Yep.
It is incredible. And my occasional annual sit-in for about a week buddy co-host, Ed Winchester, is the one that actually turned me on. He gave me the 50-hour
cool
audiobook of this.
Nice.
Yeah. So anyhow, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm sure I will give my movie review in next week's episode
sure.
of 2A Radio. But this is one of those things where there is the founding fathers, when they designed the government, they designed it after beating the king off of the new land.
Yes.
And they knew what a tyrannical government was about. They had all kinds of history. They were scholars. They were historical scholars. These guys knew what they were doing. Like when they were writing the second draft of the Constitution, a woman stopped Ben Franklin outside of Liberty Hall and asked him, Mr. Franklin, what sort of government are you putting together? His response was, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. So we've lost it. It's not a republic.
Oh, we're so far away from a republic anymore. It's yeah. a joke.
And it's actually, it's in the Pledge of Allegiance. I've actually had people who are running for political office ask, what kind of government do we have? It's a democracy.
Wrong.
Actually, yeah, it's not a democracy. Well, yeah, it is. No, it's a democratic republic. Let me. What are the words of the Pledge of Allegiance? A pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. Not to the democracy for which it says, to the republic for which it stands. And they're like, oh, what's the difference? Go Wikipedia it.
I got a quote that's like my tagline on like the online forums I'm on. It says, democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what's for lunch. Liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the
results.
Vote.
That's right.
Basically,
yeah.
with 51 if, under true democracy, 51% of the population can vote that the other 49% get killed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little over kind of a blunt, but that's what it is.
And really, in the book, Atlas Shrugged, there's a lot of that going on.
Yes.
And all you need is 50% of the people plus one that are too stupid to be making the decision. And, of course, we had that with the election of Barack Obama in the White House. My own two cents on that
yes.
one. You had too many people that don't know what's going on. Too many people that are honestly too stupid to be voting that voted.
Right,
and they voted for a guy that we know nothing about.
Yeah,
we don't know what his name was when he was born. We don't know for a fact where he's born. We don't even know for a fact that he went to Columbia. We don't know for a fact that he actually went to Harvard. We know that he turned in his license to practice law under duress. But we don't know a whole bunch about the guy.
We voted for a cult of personality. People got wrapped up in that, and it was sad to see.
We did. Eric, thanks for sitting in, man.
Oh, it was my pleasure to hang out.
And folks, stay tuned for more great programming. We'll be back next week.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you, Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com. I will not.